Hey, I'm Andy. I'm an alcoholic.
Oh,
and yeah, Sam warned me. He said, you get into it pretty quick. He wasn't kidding around. So, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 21st, 2007. And I'm a member of a home group in AA. It's the Common Solution Group in Charlottesville. We meet at 7:30 on Thursday nights. If you're ever around on Thursday in Charlottesville, we would really love to see you. I also think I should say I have a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think he knows he's my sponsor. And I also sponsor men, and I remain available to help people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's weird to say all that and then hear those words come out of my mouth and think about when I first came to AA, and I probably heard someone say something like that and think, well, that's crazy. I could never imagine myself saying any of that. But here I am. You know, also I can remember coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and not wanting to be there. I remember coming into Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm not exactly sure. I imagine in my head, I had a big fight with my wife, and she had left. She had finally had enough of all of the just madness that I created. And she started driving north to her parents. And when she left, I was like, I needed one more Hail Mary to save this thing. And so I grabbed the phone book in Charlottesville and looked up AA and called the number. And someone picked up the phone from the local office, and they gave me the time of a meeting. And I was like, all right, well, I'm going to go to the meeting. And so I called her on her phone. And like in my mind, I imagine she's probably right here on 29 going up north, you know, and I'm basically telling her, it's okay, you can come home now. You know, I've solved the problem, you know, and I'm going to go to an AA meeting. And she said, basically, I don't know exactly what she said, but the message was, good luck, you know, and she just kept driving. You know, but I didn't know if I was an alcoholic then. And I don't know how I could have, because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I didn't understand what alcoholism was. So probably wasn't very well equipped to make that determination. You know, and thinking back, I guess at that point in my life, I didn't fit whatever model of an alcoholic that I had kind of created for myself, the vision I had in my own head about what that was. Because I was still married, barely, as you just heard, and I still had a job, barely. I had a home, you know, I wasn't homeless at that time. And so I couldn't be an alcoholic, and I was too young. I was 27 years old. That didn't make sense to me. And, you know, so I just didn't understand. And thinking back, when I was younger, I think the first time I had a drink probably would have been like in the backyard with family grilling out, like dad's half-empty can of whatever he was drinking, you know, but there was no like fireworks or a great story then. Really, for me, drinking became something that starting in high school, I could kind of do to sneak out of the house, kind of break the rules, have fun with other folks, and start to do that kind of stuff. And it didn't really have a profound impact on me until I can remember this pretty clearly. I'd come to school in Charlottesville. We lived up outside of DC. And I remember the first night I was down at school, it was really cool, because like I felt like I was out of, I had no oversight, right? I'm on my own. And I went to a party with a bunch of folks at this house. And I can remember being so pumped to go just really have a good time. And I remember immediately showing up at this place and knowing I had made a huge mistake. Because I remember looking across a deck. It was like these huge, like ground level decks. And they had a trash can with a keg in it, you know, tapping a stack of the red cups upside down. And there were these guys that were maybe 2, 3 years older than me that were standing across the deck. And to me, they looked like a completely different species of being. They were probably 2 years older than me, but they looked 15 years older than me. And I just felt like I had made a terrible mistake. I don't belong here. I wouldn't know what to say or what to do. And I'm with a couple people that had come with me. And I just remember basically having the cup, pumping the keg and drinking the thing and doing the thing. And after a while, I don't think I was really noticing those guys. And after a while, it's like I'm kind of in a group of people and we're all laughing. We're all having a good time. And then I'm the one that's telling the jokes that's getting the people laughing, you know, and I'm kind of the center of attention and I'm driving the party. And then some of those faces that are laughing, they're girls that I have their attention, you know, and I have really plugged into something. And then some of the guys I'm hanging with are some of those guys that were older and we're all part of a thing and we're having a good time and making plans to do this again. And I realized like this was the missing piece for me, like being able to drink, I don't know, maybe it was 12 beers on that deck was this secret code that made me who I'm really supposed to be. And that feeling was so great for me that I just pursued that forever. Like every day, that's what I wanted to do. And some days I found it and some days I didn't. But when that was your focus, as it was mine, I didn't spend too much time on going to class. And after a while, school kind of noticed and they asked me to take some time off and I had to go figure out something to do fourth year. You know, it's just another one of these things where I find, I don't know if you ever heard us say to ourselves, it was like, I was only hurting myself, you know, little things I do. Like I was the youngest of three kids. I think my parents had thought they were done raising children when they sent me off to college. You know, they didn't expect one to come back. And I just assumed that was their role. You know, they're going to do this. Anyway, so, you know, kept drinking, I'd get in trouble and do things. I remember coming out of a blackout in a different state in a jail. And not the state that I started in. And, you know, my parents getting a call about that, you know, in the middle of the night. You know, wrecking cars, all kinds of consequences piled up in my life. But through all of that, I was able to establish a relationship with a woman that I fell in love with. And we lived out in the country in Gordonsville. And the school let me come back to finish up my degree, which was very kind of them. And I commuted in from the country and I learned how to drive all the dirt roads from Charlottesville to Gordonsville. You can basically do it where there's no cops. So like when I learned how to make it to class in the morning, you know, to show up. But as soon as class was over, I'd hit the gas station on the way out of town and get a couple 22s and head over Turkey Sag Road out towards Gordonsville and throwing bottles out the window. I ended up drinking so much beer sometimes I'd have to stop and open the car door and just throw up foam just because it's so much in a short period of time. Just crazy. But where that led me was a relationship where we're living back in Charlottesville and it was just an empty shell of a relationship. I'm working for a company that allows me to work from home, which is pretty great if you're an active alcoholic, especially if the person you're living with doesn't work from home. And so they're out of it. And, you know, what would happen to me is I would, this would be about like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. And I get this idea that, oh man, she's going to come home in a couple hours. You know, what I need to do is just go get a 12 pack, you know, up at the gas station real quick. And just so that I'm kind of I have it in me already before she comes. So she won't see me drinking all this stuff. And I'd go up to the gas station and I'd end up sometimes just get 2 12-packs. And I'd go and I'd just crush a 12-pack. And then I would try, I'd open one beer from the second 12-pack. And I'd get rid of all of the evidence from the first 12-pack, put it in the trash can in the garage so that when she smelled beer, when she got home, well, I just, I've cracked a beer open. Obviously, that's what you're smelling. And I always had a good plan. And actually, I've talked to her this, you know, years later. It was a pretty good plan. She didn't know what was, she didn't know about these mountains of evidence in the garage. But then she come home, and then it was just like, I just couldn't drink the way I wanted to drink. And I would just try to get through the evening. And inevitably, it would end up where she, all thing, all she wanted to do was for me to come to bed. Just she wanted to see me put the lights out, you know, like turn it off just so that she wouldn't worry. And I would just always try to, I'd always have a reason why I needed to stay up. And it was some sports thing that's going to have an implication next season that she doesn't understand or whatever it is. And I would sit in the chair in our living room, and she would go down to the bedroom and shut the door, and like a normal human being, which I just didn't identify with at the time, she would just read something before she'd go to bed. And I would see, the way I'd know that is I looked down the hallway and I could see where she closed the door. There's, you know, there's like a half inch gap between the floor and the door. And I could see the light on. I made a little arc out in the hallway, like a light. And it, for me, it was just like a sign, like an indicator. I would just look down and I'd see, oh, she's still reading, you know. And I'd sit back up and stare blankly ahead until I'd finally look down and the, I could tell the light was off. And really, like, this is the moment that I felt just the relief where I could just be like, like, now I can do what I want to do. And I would get up and I'd walk into the kitchen and I'd find whatever I had left, whatever bottles of anything. And I had a thought, it was a pretty good technique, where I would spread the bottles in my fingers so they wouldn't clink, because I don't want her to hear. And I would mosey over to the door onto our porch, and I would use an elbow just to quietly kind of go out there. And I just sit outside in the dark and just kind of just drink. And I drink till, I mean, it sounds like dramatic, but I'm going to tell you, I drink to oblivion. I wasn't mad at anybody. I wasn't, don't remember anyone or anything, the target of my like ire as I'm just drinking. I was just drinking. And the next thing I know, it's like that. I'm like kind of coming awake. My eyes aren't even open yet. And I start to have these thoughts really fast. Like, where am I? What did I do? Like, did I, God, am I home? And I'd open my eyes and see I'm home. And I'm like, okay, I wonder if the car's still here. Like, did I wreck anything? You know, you start all these thoughts real quick. And then I'd slowly get up out of bed, and I'd have these thoughts like, I can't believe I've done this whole thing again. You know, like I have maybe hurt the person I love the most. You know, maybe I have destroyed something. I don't, but here I am again. I feel like just this is ridiculous that I've done this. I feel so ashamed. And I would, I didn't have a relationship with God. I love the introduction to remind us about our stories is how we found a relationship with power greater than ourselves. I didn't have one at that time, but in those moments, I would say something. I would be making a promise to something, like, I'm not going to do this anymore. Like, I am done. And the reason why is, like, looking back on it, it's not for like the wrong reasons. It's because I don't want to hurt her anymore. You know, I don't want to damage this stuff. Like, I want this to be better. I want to be a better, you know, husband. And I would be done with alcohol. Like, really done. You know, like a honest promise. Was it in the book? It talks about, you know, with and without a solemn oath. You know, I had a solemn oath on this. And I'd get up, she'd get up, we'd have whatever fight we had to have based on whatever wreckage I had left. She would go off to work. I would get some greasy food to try to soak this stuff up, try to feel a little better, try to drink some water. I'd probably get a nap in because I'm probably pretty tired. So now I'm really getting down to work at about 11:30. Really going to get some work in. Right about like 1:30 or 2 o'clock, I'm like, she's going to be home in about 2 hours. So if I can just go get a 12 pack, I can get this. It'll be fine. It's hilarious, right? When we think about how we make this change, but it's so real that I can know in my heart, like I want to stop in a few hours, maybe a nap, some food and some like water. And it's just not as big of a deal as it was, It talks about how alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And this is how I know it is because I've had this experience in my life where of my own, I can't, I do not stand a chance. I will drink again. The memory of the last drink is completely insufficient to stop me from taking another drink. I'm alcoholic. So that's where we got to how I was telling you guys tonight is that at some point, as anyone would in this type of relationship, they had enough and she just left, So now I've promised her I'm going to AA as a really a kind of a, it's like a con job, right? I'm trying to get her home, but I'm like, I better go. So, I remember going to meetings and I remember being terrified somebody's going to see me. So I'm like in my car, parked on the street, not the parking lot. And I'm waiting until like it's an 8 o'clock meeting. I'm waiting until like 8:01. And then I'm kind of like scurrying through to the door to get in there. And then I want to get out. And I hear a lot of what people are saying. And I hear people talking about you got to get a sponsor. And so I did that. I got a sponsor early on. And then I would avoid the sponsor. And this was a guy that's like very committed in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's very consistent in Alcoholics Anonymous. So he's going to be at this meeting on Tuesday. He's going to be at this meeting on Thursday. He's going to be here on Friday. Here on, so I know where he's going to be. And I just would not go there. I would go to the other ones. And it was cool because I'm the new guy. And so people are like, oh, hey, do you have a sponsor? You a sponsor? I'm like, oh, buddy, I'm covered. I've got a sponsor. Don't worry about it. And a week goes by, 2 weeks go by. At some point, my wife comes home. We're on like separate sides of the house, but this is working. Another month goes by, 2 months go by. I'm starting to notice in these meetings when I come in, like everybody's like really happy to be here. Feels like everybody knows everybody. And people are like, oh, hey, what's going on with that thing you were telling me? Like everybody's just like this, it's like this family. They're all just happy and wonderful. And I feel like I want to kill you. I want to punch you in the face when you smile at me. And I'm not happy. And I am frustrated to my core. And at work, I'm just completely focused on how the owners of the business that I work for don't get it. And they're not doing it right. And if they only, like they just, if they would just listen to, like, seriously, I know what needs to be done here, which, as you can imagine, doesn't go well in the workplace. In the house, every conversation, every interaction I have with my wife ends in like a fight, like a shouting match, like a screaming. And it's always something, but it's just I'm completely frustrated. And I think the thing that's going in the back of my head is, don't you people realize like what I am doing for you? I haven't had a drink in 2 months. Right. And I'm not saying anything about it. I'm going to my meetings, but for God's sake, like, where is my parade? Do you know what I mean? Like, I've never said that. And my family just knows that that's my, like, today, even if I do something around the house and it's not noticed, then I might want to, like, oh, hey, did you see that? That bookcase got put together, huh? Anybody notice that? You know, my family is just like, oh, hey, everybody come around, like, dad needs this parade. You know, and everybody's like giving dad. So they understand who I am. And it's a funny thing. But at that moment, that's the only thing that was consuming me. You know, it's just like, I just didn't get the level of appreciation for what I was doing for you. And I go to these meetings and you guys are different. You guys are happy. And I start to get this idea going back and forth between my ears that maybe I'm not like you. Maybe I have some other things going on in my life and in my head, a little more complicated than this simple AA thing. I mean, this is in church basements. I've been in church basements for Sunday school. I remember doing construction, paper projects, art projects with Elmer's glue, and it's kind of silly stuff. And it's free. You get what you pay for. So clearly this isn't, it doesn't have the weight for the complexity and the depth. I mean, clearly it's not working, right? I'm going to these meetings and I'm not getting whatever you guys may need, but, and, you know, my grand sponsor, I feel like now I've heard him say hundreds of times the phrase terminally unique, and how we have a problem here as alcoholics being not, we don't want to be a part of, feel different, separate from, unique. And it's so bad as an alcoholic that difference, that uniqueness can be terminal. It'll kill me. I'm terminally unique. And so I am probably at what would be my last AA meeting, I think. I'm right, really ready on the edge to just go do something else because it sucks. We talked in the book, it talks about the jumping off place. You can't imagine life with alcohol and life without it. I don't think I thought about it explicitly at that time. But now looking back on it, man, that's where I was. Because I knew that when I was drinking, I burned down everything around me. I couldn't do that. But now I'd gone a few months without drinking. And you know, honestly, it might be a little worse. So that's the jumping off place. I can't imagine life with alcohol and I can't without it. And I'm at the end here. And I'm in a meeting and a guy shared something. And what's funny is I'd probably heard him say it a bunch of times before, but when we're ready to hear something, I believe, then we're ready to hear it and like hear what it means. And he said, for an alcoholic, alcohol isn't their problem, it's their solution. And he said something to the effect of, if you take alcohol away, things might not get better. In fact, it might get a lot worse without a sufficient substitute. And I don't know what it was about that meeting. Maybe it was because I was so low. Maybe it was really at the jumping off point. Maybe I was finally out of answers, you know? But I heard it and I heard what it meant. And what it meant was I had taken away the one thing that I had ever used to get peace of mind or to turn the noise off or to feel a part of. And I hadn't replaced it with anything. I'd replaced it with a sponsor in name only, which means I can tell you his name, and that's about as far as the relationship goes. And so what clicked into place for me that night was that maybe I'm not different. Maybe I'm not so complicated and so complex, too complex for AA. Maybe I'm an alcoholic who needs a sufficient substitute. Um, Have you guys ever heard people say Alcoholics Anonymous is a simple program for complicated people? I believe, I mean, if that's what you think, that's cool. But I believe that AA is a simple program for people who think they're complicated. And so in that moment, I remember, it's like I just knew what to do. And I called my sponsor and I just got completely honest with him. And we sat down and I agreed, and we met in his Volvo and read out of the big book and started taking the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just quit running the show. You know, I made commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous where, you know, I was telling you about the sponsor where he's going to, I knew where he was going to be. After that point, you knew where I was going to be. And there'd be meetings that, like, if you went to, you knew that that's, you're going to see me there. We used to go to, my sponsor would strongly recommend I'd go to like a conference, a workshop out of town, you know, and so I'd get in the car. And sometimes, you know, I'd drive. Not all the new alcoholics had a car available to them, so I'd offer to, you know, drive. And, you know, I met Billy and Lynn at that first year sober down at Pockets of Enthusiasm. And, you know, having that opportunity to see people that are doing AA that aren't the people I see at my meetings, you know, and folks that can make Alcoholics Anonymous attractive, you know, something that I want to be a part of, was really powerful for me early in AA. Yeah, and then I got perfect and I'm all good. you know, the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous for me is something that, like, I really focused on that first year of, like, sitting with my sponsor, reading the book, taking these steps. But, you know, I am always involved in this process. We live in steps 10, 11, and 12. You know, I'm asked to, I continue to take personal inventory. I promptly make amends when I've wronged someone, you know, or this process. Unfortunately, I don't get to graduate. You know, I was in a meeting recently. We were talking about the 12th step. And it's like, the first time you look at that, you kind of feel like you get conned. You think you're going to get to 12 and you get the diploma and you get to graduate and go away. It's like, no. Now you have to give to people, you know, it's this loop. And that's where we live now. And that's good because I know that as an alcoholic, the center of my problem lies in selfishness and self-centeredness. You know, with my sponsor early on, it was frustrating because I would call him and I would talk to him about a lot of frustrating things that are going on with me. And I'll tell you, he didn't really seem to care how I felt. He did care a lot about what I was doing, right? He'd ask me what meeting I was going to, what alcoholics I had spoken to. And the message I took from that, which I still understand today, is that living based on spiritual principles is more about what my feet are doing and less about how I feel. And I know today that I might feel good, I might feel bad. It really doesn't matter. What does matter is, am I say where I'm going to, I am where I'm going to be. You know, that's a message that I learned here. And I will tell you, I was a guy that my whole life, I was not where I said I was going to be. I was not reliable. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me ways to learn to be reliable. The steps of Alcoholics Anonymous were, you know, amazing to go through that first time. I learned a lot about myself. I thought in the fourth step, but in my fifth step, I learned even more because I got kind of reflection off of a sponsor where he was able to share some of his experience. And I learned early on that I didn't want to write some things down because in my mind, I was like, I don't want to make amends for this. Right? So I didn't want to write something down in a fourth step because I'm already thinking about that ninth step down the list, you know. And it was really helpful working with a sponsor that you could always remind me, it's like, we're not on the ninth step. You know, we're just making a list right now. That's what we're doing. That stuff's really helpful to me. And I really carried this fear of the ninth step with me. And I will tell you guys that, like, that step was such an eye opener for me that it's given me so many gifts that have lasted till today. And I made amends for things like complete range of things. Things like when I was younger, I'd take things that weren't mine from maybe a person or also from a store. And, you know, I worked with a sponsor on how I can go back and make that stuff right. And you know, sometimes that stuff's scary because you're afraid of legal repercussions and all that stuff. But I'm asked the question here, you know, do I want to stay sober? And so I went back and made all of that stuff. And every time I've been amazed at the gifts that it's brought. But some of the harder ones to make were things about, like, sometimes the people closest to us. And the experience that I had that really changed something in me, at least with this person, and then it also with other people, is when I sat down to make amends with my mom. And I'll tell you, like, going into it too, I don't think I really understood what the purpose was, because I'm a guy, like, my whole life, I feel like I'm kind of an expert on telling people I'm sorry. Like, I've done that a lot. I have always had to go back to people and say, I'm sorry for doing something. And really why I want to do that, if I do it right, if I say I'm sorry, I'm right, you might forgive me. And you might like me more. And you might pat me on the back, tell me I'm doing a good job. So I think I brought that kind of perspective into this night step. I'm thinking that's kind of what this thing is. And I got a lot of guidance from my sponsor that, you know, all I was to do going into this was to focus on the harms that I had caused that other person. And so I made this list and focus on the harm. So with my mom, you know, I had a long list of stuff that ways that I knew I'd harmed her. And he helped me distill that down to a list that, as he said, was she would understand that I understood. You know? So we put this list together. And he wrote out this bullet list of things that I was to do in the amends. Number one was call sponsor. Number two was pray. Number three was go in to meet with the person and tell them how you've harmed them. Number four was ask them if you've left anything out. Number five was, I think he wrote, shut up. Number six was ask them what you can do to make it right. And then it was shut up. And then it was pray and call sponsor. It was the last one. And I don't know, he wrote this stuff down. He seemed very proud of himself with this list. And he wanted to review it all the time. And so we reviewed it all the time. And he got down in there. And I remember going and pulling up to the, he helped me understand that, like, this is on the other person's schedule, right? I'm not supposed to just blast into their life with this big conversation. Like, I made sure that asked if she had time to meet with me. You know, we scheduled a time that was convenient to her. And so I drove to meet her at this time. Anyway, it was at her house, and I remember driving, pulling up in the driveway. And, like, I had this thought that was, you know, I don't have to do this. Like, I don't have to do this. You know, nobody's going to arrest me for not doing this. And I really didn't want to do it. And I had this stupid piece of paper. And the first thing was call sponsor. So I called sponsor. And he told me to do the second thing, which was pray. Okay. And I prayed, asked God to, you know, help me be willing to go walk in there and see my mom. And I don't know. There's the line in our book that, like, you know, we'll see God doing for ourselves what we could not do for us, what we could not do for ourselves. And all I know is I opened that door and I stood up and I closed the door and I walked into the house, and, like, I didn't want to do that. And I feel like that was God working in my life. I would never have done that. I would have gone. But I walked in, I sat down with her, and I had this silly little list. And so I told her how I'd harmed her, and I said the things that I was going to say. And she listened. And then I asked her if I had left anything out. Was there anything I left out? And it was like Billy had called ahead and prompted her that she was going to have this opportunity because I was like, I left you down. And I mean, she didn't do this, but I think back on it, it's like she pulled out a clipboard actually. And she just like, she was ready to fill in some blanks. And, you know, it's like mom just, you know, oh my God, here I am again. And I've got this next step, which is shut up, you know. So I'm like, all right, be quiet. And in my mind, she's saying things, and I'm like, in my mind, it's like, well, yeah, but that's not really what happened, is what I'm thinking. Or, yeah, but you don't understand what he said about that. Or, you know, but that's not really what I meant when I was doing that thing. You know, like I have. I'm supposed to shut up. So I remember I put my hands down and I sat on my hands. I felt like that would help me be quiet. It doesn't make any sense. This is what I did. And she's just going, blah, 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 blah. And then all of a sudden I start to hear like really what she's saying. And I'm like, oh, like that's different. You know, like I did. So it was something like that I just didn't realize, you know? And then I looked up at her and I made eye contact. But I had this sensation that like the person that I was making eye contact with, it was like I had never, it was like a different person. Like I hadn't seen this person before. And when I looked at my mom, I saw her and she wasn't, it wasn't like I was looking at my mom, the character, like the role, the person that I she looked just like a woman that was really like devastated, really. Like really hurt and was really trying to explain to me how she was hurt. And it might just sound like crazy, but like I had never seen her as a woman, like a human. I don't think I'd ever had. And so I started to realize that, and I was just like, it was the weight of it was pretty significant. And I realized that I was seeing like the hurt that came from like all of the stuff that I did that I didn't even think about, like all of the impacts of the nights where she doesn't know where I am, or like the calls that you get in the middle of the night. And so I walked away from that with a realization that like how many relationships do I have in my life where my perception of it is just completely wrong. And I asked her how I could what I could do to make that right. And in that situation, you know, she asked for some things. Like she wanted to hear from me regularly to know what's going on in my life. And she wanted me to come to like holidays and not be drunk when I drove up. And she wanted to have enough understanding of what I was doing that she just wasn't afraid all the time. And so we agreed to that, right? And so I realized that like we talk a lot about the amends and we focus on like sitting down with this person, but that's where we just kind of drew up the agreement of what the amends would be. And then I have to go out and I have to carry out my end of it, which is whatever we agreed to do to right that wrong. And I still do that today with her. And we have an amazing relationship, but like things like that in AA, these experiences I have, if I let myself do them, it's usually things that I don't want to do, right? It's like we talk about being divinely inconvenienced. It's opportunities where I'm able to just say, I am open to this experience, no matter how, if I don't understand it, I might not even believe it'll work. It doesn't matter. I'm just going to do it. I'm going to be open to like to experience it. And I have all of these significant changes in perspective. And the one that comes out of the amends, this idea that just like I might be wrong about almost everything. Like I might have a miscalculation of what really happened. You know, and some time tell you a couple stories. So, Alcoholics Anonymous allowed me to clean up a lot of the damage. We have some really incredible gifts here. This thing is like, we won't regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it, which sounds outrageous. But my experience has been when I take all of this crap that I've done and hid from everyone for years, you know, the stuff that you like, you think about when everything's quiet, like maybe it's late at night, or for me, it was like usually in the shower in the morning when I'm getting ready. It's like everything's quiet. Then I thought I'd think about those things, you know, that I had done. Alcoholics Anonymous allows me to share that with somebody in a fifth step and then be able to make amends for the harms that I had caused others. And the cool thing about that is that now it's happened several times. I'll be sitting with a guy and he's reading his fourth step to me in a fifth step. And I can see in his eyes that he's looking at something on that page and he's not 100% sure if he's going to say it out loud, you know? And I can be sitting there and I know, and you know, he's like me, whatever, he just lets it happen. He just says, I give up, you know, and he has this experience and he shares the thing. And I hear me, you know, and then I say to, you know, and it's like I was, he's looking for, like, he's afraid he's going to be judged or he's afraid he's going to be. And I'm able in those instances to share those things that I have in my history that I was able to share with a sponsor, that I was able to make amends for. And those are the things that today I know that are a part of me that are might be some of my most valuable things, because those are the things that can make another alcoholic feel like they're in the right place, you know, that they're doing the right thing. They're going, they fit here, they belong. And so that's why we don't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it, because that stuff's valuable today, you know, especially to an alcoholic that thinks they're different. And so if I take this stuff through the process, it's amazing. That stuff becomes some of the most valuable things I have in my life. You know, and so my experience at Alcoholics Anonymous got a little more time, sponsored some more guys, and you know, really feel like I just achieved the pinnacle of AA and really still looking for the diploma, and it just never came. And you know, spiritual giant place, you know. And it's funny, it's like whenever I get to feeling really good or like I figured something out, I don't know if it's God or higher power, but just I have an experience that tells me I don't understand anything. And the one that a really powerful experience about 10 years ago when my wife was pregnant with twins, and we got a call that the twins, that her water had broken. The twins were coming early, and it was about 27 weeks, I think, along. So it was very early. And we went to the hospital, and I remember I was really, really freaked out and upset and kind of riding this roller coaster of, oh God, what's going to happen? And I remember they put us in this room with like a lot of personnel. I feel there's like four nurses running around, and apparently I was, let's just say, not helpful, because one of the nurses came over to me like, sir, is there anyone that you can talk to or call? Like, if not, we have people you can talk to. And you know, I realized that like I was kind of becoming the center of attention for this thing. And I realized I do have people I can talk to. I do. And so I called my sponsor and I called guys in my home group, kind of let them know what's going on. And you know, got real centered on what my role is here. And I remember coming back and found out some great news that there was a doctor who was not normally at the hospital, but he was there for a period of time, who was like the expert in this specific thing that was happening with my wife and the babies. And I'm like, oh, great. AA works. And, so I am thrilled. And I'm like, I'm going to be useful. I'm going to be helpful, you know. And I remember saying to the doctor when he came in to sit with her and to do what he has to do. And then I had a chance to talk to him. And I'm like, listen, man, I'm going to do whatever. Like, just tell me what I can do, what we can do here. You know, how can we fix this, make this work? And, you know, he's got all this stuff. He's like, he just looked up at me and he goes, you can pray. You know, like, and I'm like, I went from spiritually centered to like, I need something sharp to stab this doctor. And the reason is because like, no, dude. You're the doctor. You're the expert. We're at a hospital. Like, I'm not at an AA meeting at a podium. You're going to be like, I'm going to pray. Like, that's not what this is. Like, you did your job. You know, you need to fix this thing. And he told me what I could do and what she could do was pray. And man, how easily I forget how the ego gets rebuilt, that I think I can control or I'm in charge of any of this. And I'm indignant when someone points out that I'm not. And I'll tell you, I got right-sized in a second. So what I did is I prayed. And my wife prayed. My wife's a member of another 12-step group. And she talked to the women in her life. And basically what we did is we had about, and I say we like I was, this was all her, right? But like, I like to participate in this experience. But there was about 10, 11 days where the job was to not have babies. So like basically you wait and you pray that every hour is important, right? That they're not born, because every bit of time is good for those kids in there and not out here with us. And so, you know, I got focused on what my purpose was, and it wasn't solving that problem. It was being present for her. It was being the best dad to my son who's at home. It was being a good sponsor to my sponsees. It was being a good home group member. It was talking to my sponsor and doing these things. And I remember there were guys that I worked with at the time that were like afraid to talk to me because they knew what I was dealing with us. But I was like, no, man, you don't understand. Like, let's do this. Let's talk, you know? And so I got out of the way and we just let happen whatever was supposed to happen, which just not none of my business, really. We were just along for the ride. And so eventually they came about 10, 11 days later, and my daughter Annie was like less than 3 pounds. Winnie was just over 3 pounds, tiny little babies. And it was crazy. We ended up spending like 3.5 months in the NICU with them before they were able to come home, you know. And I was obsessed the whole time, basically worried about what this means, you know, like, are they going to be able to breathe on their own? Are they going to be able to do these things on their own? And, you know, it took me a long time to realize a lot of those fears too weren't, you know, they were really about me. I didn't want to be the dad that had to devote extra time and energy to kids that needed more, you know, like I learned a lot about how selfishness and self-centeredness really shows up. And, you know, that story for me is about that experience I had in the hospital and knowing that whenever I think I've got it all figured out, God has a way of reminding me that my job is not to have anything figured out. It's to be helpful, you know, and it's to be helpful to an alcoholic when I think that I've got bigger things going on. And, you know, just not the point of the story, but I want to tell you, I've got two daughters now that are going to be 11 this summer, and they are a complete pain in the ass. They are loud and healthy, and they have attitudes. One, I'm pretty sure, is going to be a member of this fellowship one day, but maybe both. But you know, that wasn't up to me, and it's not up to me. So much of my life and experience is not up to me, and I just forget that. What is up to me is what I'm doing here in AA to be helpful and useful to somebody else. Yeah, I think I'm gonna end there, but I want to tell you guys how grateful I am to have the chance to share just what came to me today with you guys. And sometimes when I do this stuff, I want to be helpful to folks I'm sharing with. But the truth is, like you might say to your sponsor, here's what's like, I think it might be more helpful to me today to have the opportunity to share than it is for you guys. But I'm grateful. Thank you so much. Yeah.